Thank you for having me, Joe.
Hi, welcome to the podcast. I am Joe Posnanski, and with me, super awesome guest of the week, Jay Jaffe, author, writer, father, genius, just everything. He's, Jay is just everything. But we're going to mostly be talking about Jay's new book, the Cooperstown Casebook, who's in the Baseball Hall of Fame, who should be in, and who should pack their plaques. Jay, how you doing?
Hey, I'm great, Joe. Good to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you. This is great because I'm pretty sure you and I are the two biggest Hall of Fame nerds in America. Yes? Would you agree?
I would agree. The only other person I think who probably makes the platform is Graham Womack of the Sporting News. But I would say between the three of us, we probably write more about the Hall of Fame than any other writers in America.
Yeah, and we shouldn't overlook Graham because Graham's out there interviewing guys, asking them about going to the Hall of Fame. So yeah,
Graham's absolutely. Shout out to Graham.
Graham is great. So we're going to talk a lot about the Hall of Fame, and we're going to talk, I think, quite a bit about next year's class and who we think are in, who we think are out. It's going to be a lot of fun. Before we go on, I do want to tell you about the MLB StatCast podcast, which is awesome, by the way. Two great friends of mine, Mike Petriello and Matt Myers, do all sorts of StatCasts. Last week, they investigated StatCast angles for pre-deadline deals, debated Adrian Beltre's place among the all-time great third basemen, which I know we'll talk a little Adrian Beltre. If there's something you want to hear, search for StatCast Podcast on Apple Podcasts or go to www.statcastpodcast.com. Now we go on with the show. So, Jay, first of all, let's start from the very sort of start because I'm very curious about this. First of all, the book is great. Do you think, because it's not just us. I mean, we joke about us being kind of the biggest nerds about this. Why do we care? Why do we care about the Baseball Hall of Fame so much?
You know, I think it's because, every fan can imagine, just about every baseball fan has some kind of reaction to Cooperstown, whether it's I don't care,
right,
or I do care, and you know, and therefore, they have some beef with the Hall of Fame. It's, you know, Pete Rose should be in, Barry Bonds should be in, or not. They all have some beef. They all want to see their own experiences validated. I saw Tim Raines play when he was the best player in the National League. I really want him. You know, I really think he belongs in the Hall of Fame. I think because baseball lends itself so well to the numbers, and because we have such consciousness of those numbers, we have at least some vague understanding of what makes a Hall of Famer, or we think we do, and that kind of translates in it. But mostly, I think it's just because we want our experiences validated to have seen some of these greats when they were in action, and look forward to a time when they're housed under the same roof as Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Cy Young, Walter Johnson, etc.
Yeah, it's very, very personal to people in a way that's weird when you compare it to other sports. I mean, I don't think it's the same thing for football or for basketball. Maybe it is for hockey. I have heard some of the same passion in things like golf, you know, stuff like that.
I didn't even know golf had a Hall of Fame.
It does, and it's quite controversial. There are controversies. That could be your next book. But it's different, and I think your point is right. I think there is a very angry nature to people that's different. Like, for instance, Steve Garvey. So people who grew up watching Steve Garvey play were convinced they were watching one of the greatest players of all time at the time, right? They were convinced.
Right.
And so to say all these years later, oh, Steve Garvey falls short of the Hall of Fame, it's an affront to them in a way that I think is different. And I think maybe it's the numbers. Maybe it's that baseball relies more on its history maybe than other sports do. But I don't get the same sense. Like, I grew up as a Cleveland Browns fan. I was thrilled when Ozzie Newsome went into the Hall of Fame. I thought it was great. But if Ozzie Newsome had not gone to the Hall of Fame, I don't think I would have had any sort of like, oh, that's terrible. I mean, he's a Hall of Famer, But I do have those feelings about those baseball players that I saw. It just feels like it's different somehow.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it's so granular now, especially, you know, given the fact that the majority of voters reveals their ballots at some point. It's so granular that you can connect, you know, an individual vote to an individual voter. I don't know that you can do that for any of the other halls of fame. You know, we don't see the same kind of grassroots type lobbying efforts to get a football player into the Hall of Fame or whatever as you do with baseball. I mean, we've now seen two major ones in the last decade in Burt Blyleven and Tim Raines, and there are some other ones that are maybe a little bit further down the list as well. I mean, Dick Allen with the Veterans Committee. Sure. You know, and I think the success of the Reigns campaign only encourages more. I'm certainly ready to start up the Edgar Martinez bandwagon here in earnest with his two final years remaining on the ballot.
Absolutely. And I think that point is right. I think that these guys become a cause. I mean, it does happen a little bit in other sports. I remember I was involved in a pretty substantial Kansas City effort in football to get Otis Taylor, the wide receiver, into the Hall of Fame. So it does happen, but I think this process is so much more open. Like in football, you don't really know. It's just it's, you know, 35, 40 guys getting it. I guess there are a couple of women now. It used to be just literally 35, 40 guys get into a room and sort of fight it out and then come out with who the Hall of Famers are. And so this is a much more open process and, you know, it's interesting because I think everybody certainly talks about the Blyleven one, which I think was the first one with Rich Lederer and those guys. Tim Raines is, you know, was such an extraordinary campaign that Jonah Carey, who was certainly on the forefront of that, actually gets thanked in the Tim Raines speech, which I thought was awesome. But I don't think it's just the internet. I mean, certainly there was a very strong Jim Rice campaign that was not statistically or internet driven. I think there was a very strong Jack Morris campaign that I think eventually will get Jack Morris into the Hall of Fame. So it's coming from all different angles, but people pick players and they're passionate about it.
Yeah. The other thing that just occurred to me is, do we even know, you know, what the voting levels are for other halls of fame when they do fall short? I mean, do we know that, say, Otis Taylor was getting 62% of the vote until whatever year? Because we have, it's just like everything else with baseball, we just have this huge volume of data that we can analyze. And we could see Burt Blyleven's support levels from year to year and Jack Morris's levels from year to year and whatever. And that sort of feeds into the fact that this has become almost a spectator sport unto itself. It's the flip side of hot stove season. If you don't care about you know, what your team is doing, or if your team's not doing anything at the moment, you can turn your attention to that, because it's a whole other you know, set of games and outcomes.
That's a great point, because, for instance, you talk about another sport, you know, that I was, and I'm not going to say super involved in, but I wrote a piece about how ridiculous it is that Lefty Driesell is not in the Basketball Hall of Fame based on his incredible, which, you know, and that's another thing in baseball. There's sort of you don't go up to people and say, oh, Barry Bonds, is he in or is he? Everybody knows, right? But in other sports, like I say to people, like, it's ridiculous, Lefty Driesell's not in the Hall of Fame. And they'll say, oh, I thought he was. Like, that's sort of the general reaction. But your point is 100% right in that I don't know that Lefty Driesell is any closer to the Hall of Fame than he was 5 years ago. I have there's no way to sort of judge that, how that moves. It's not like he's up to 53% or 57%. It's literally, they just walk in a door and then they come out and say he's in or he's out. Right. I mean, so that's, you're right. I think that's a big, big part of this thing. But I also think there's a big part of this is with the character of baseball, right? Is that we want to believe, whether it's true or not, and we know it's not entirely true, but we want to believe that Babe Ruth is playing the same sport as Lou Gehrig, as Ted Williams, as Hank Aaron, as Willie Mays, as Johnny Bench, as Barry Bonds, right? They're all playing the same game.
Sure.
And we want to be able to cross generations, I think, in baseball in a way that we don't necessarily in other sports.
Yeah, I don't think anybody, you know, talks about whether Sammy Baugh and Tom Brady are on the same plane.
that's 100% right. All right, so in doing this book and you know, having written books and done these sorts of interviews, the question that everybody always asks, you know, and I'm sure you've gone through a bunch of these interviews already, so you've been asked this question. People always ask you, what surprised you? That's the big book question. Like, when in doing this book, what surprised you? Right. Well, so you can ask that.
Yeah. I mean, going back to just the original, to like the form, the creation of Jaws, which was in the winter of 2003, 2004.
Explain it a little bit for
baseball perspective. Okay. So, you know, to back up, I had started writing about the Hall of Fame at Futility Infielder, my blog, in the winter of 2001, 2002. At the time, the new Bill James Historical Abstract was brand spanking new. He had just introduced WinShares. The Politics of Glory, which I bought as Whatever Happened to the Hall of Fame, was less than a decade old. And I was, you know, curious to see what James's new metrics said about the Hall of Fame. About the Hall of Fame ballot, and I kind of played around with some stuff with that. Did it for a couple years and got, you know, bonkers traffic relative to my piddling little rate of a couple hundred people a day. And you know, to the point that Baseball Prospectus invited me to do something for them for the 2004 ballot. They had just introduced, I guess maybe a year before, wins above replacement player, a better all-encompassing value metric than James's win shares, I think, sure. Because it sets a higher replacement level and is maybe a little bit more usable in that way. Doesn't have a 52-48 split between fielders and hitters,
right.
Pitching and
right.
Hitting. You know, it made at least some intuitive sense to me. So I wanted to see where, you know, because I was writing this for BP, I wanted to see where BP's metrics took us. And I figured that by using wins above replacement player, I could get away from being so attached to the round numbers, 3,000 hits, 500 home runs, 300 wins,
sure.
To get towards, a more level playing field in terms of the wide variations of scoring throughout baseball history. Easier to compare, 1960s Sandy Koufax, low run environment to, somebody we're seeing in the 2000s or somebody in the dead ball era.
Yeah.
And I also was stuck on this notion that James had introduced in his first historical abstract, and I believe it was 1985, this distinction between career ranking and peak ranking.
This idea that
if you, depending on how you define it, you can get two different answers to the question of who's the all-time best.
Sure.
And so, James had done some of that in the new historical abstract by, he used like a guy's best three seasons, his best five consecutive seasons, and a weighted average of per 162 games, I think it was, in determining his overall rankings. That was, I thought that was a bit excessive for my purposes. But what I did was fill out a spreadsheet where I was doing this by hand. And at the time, I had just dealing with the aftermath of labrum surgery on my right shoulder, which knocked me out of ski season. I was home in Salt Lake City with my folks and missing out on skiing. So here I am learning to use Excel and filling in this spreadsheet by hand. For each player's career wins above replacement total, each Hall of Famer's career total and his best five consecutive seasons, making allowances for military service and severe injuries and things like that, the color line, whatever. And the initial surprise to me was that Jack Morris did not look much like a Hall of Famer by that method, and that Burt Blyleven did.
Yeah,
and we know what happened there. It became a battleground in like the culture war, the same culture war that spawned Moneyball. This battle between old school and new school thinking, these newfangled stats, and I wrote about that in the book. It's chapter 6.
Yes,
that surprised me, and I think anytime you're surprised by your own finding, I mean, I think you get the sense you might be onto something. And in this case, I sort of struck gold. Whereas Rich Lederer, I think, was coming at it, from a maybe from a more traditional standpoint,
sure.
You know, and looking at his numbers, and I think that you know was part of the reason why he was so successful in reaching some people who maybe weren't ready to accept wins above replacement player or Jaws or whatever. You know, so there was that surprise. Going to, you know, fast forwarding 15 years here and then putting together this book, I mean, I found surprises at every corner because yeah. I had to dig into, you know, the careers of all 220 major leaguers in the Hall of Fame. And, you know, there were probably 50 guys that maybe I, you know, what I knew of them, you wouldn't fit in a whole sentence. Bobby Wallace. Yeah, I think he was a shortstop around the turn of the century. You know, right. that's all I got.
Yeah.
So, you know, I learned a lot of surprising things about guys. You know, some very interesting facts and very funny stories occasionally about even the most marginal Hall of Famers. And, you know, I think in the course of the, you know, 3+ years of writing this, I mean, I came to really enjoy, you know, the stories of these guys that I would just as soon put their plaques in the basement, you know, as some of the best. I mean, Chick Hafey, for example, you know, a guy who is the 59th best left fielder of all time, according to Jaws, and the worst, according to, in the Hall of Fame. You know, he was the first player depicted to be wearing glasses on his plaque, and his vision was so variable that he rotated with 3 different prescriptions depending upon how he felt. Maybe one of them was hungover, maybe one of them was his sinus pressure, whatever. I mean, those things were interesting, and they're just like surprising. I was surprised how much I care about these guys, even though, you know, as Hall of Famers go, they're horrible examples. You know, and that was. It was like that at every turn. I just learned so much about these guys, and I think, you know, one of the reasons why people have responded to this book as they have so far is because I think my enthusiasm for even these crappy Hall of Famers comes through. You know, Tommy McCarthy, the worst right fielder in the Hall of Fame.
Right.
I learned really that he was in there. And this is a guy who's got 16.1 career WAR. That's like less than 2 good Mike Trout seasons. You know, he's in there basically because he's a pioneer. You know, he popularized the hit and run play, the fake bunt, and the outfield trap. You know, all of which are pretty interesting innovations. He just shouldn't have been inducted for his playing. He should have been inducted for pioneering them in the same way that Candy Cummings was for popularizing the curveball.
Yeah.
You know, and that way you take him off the table as far as considering the numbers. So there were all kinds of surprises like that. And, you know, I think that constant level of discovery for me is what helped make this project bearable.
Well, bearable is the word.
Bearable on my end because 3.5 years, you know, yeah. from first contact to seeing this book hit the shelves is a long time.
And
in this day and age, it's not always that rewarding to write a book. So, you know, it was that that kept me coming back for more and wanting to dive in and, you know, picking myself up after a 10-hour workday and trying to fit 2 more hours in, just to, you know, further my knowledge and bring something to the reader.
Well, and by the way, bearable is the word that every author uses at the end of writing, right? I mean, it's hard to write a book. I mean, it just is. I want to talk a little bit more about Morris and Blyleven because to me that was a huge turning point in this process. I think it was a little bit like the Moneyball argument, and I think it's really what sort of the simple. You know, brilliance, I think, of Jaws is, I don't know that, you know, and I know Bill has written about this certainly, but there's basically nothing in baseball discovery that doesn't at some point in some level go back to Bill James. But I think the idea of these two sort of notions, this notion of how good were you at your peak and how good were you over your entire career is... It really is. It's that crossroads where greatness is. I mean, I think there are people like Dwight Gooden who at their very peak were as good as maybe anybody who's ever played the game. But most people would argue. I mean, I know there are some people who think Gooden should be in the Hall of Fame, but there are those people, most people would argue he wasn't great long enough.
Right.
And then there are other people who were very, very good for extremely long periods of time. And you looked at them and you say, okay, well, that person, you know, was very, very good for very long, but they really were never great. And they were never great at, you know, they were never great for an extended period of time. Maybe, you know, maybe a Harold Baines would be somebody like that. So you look at these guys, and again, this is a fluctuating concept. Everybody argues how long you have to be great or how great you have to be or whatever. But this idea of that crossroads, and I thought that with Jack Morris, that's where the fight was. The fight was that Burt Blyleven was never great, and the fight was that Jack Morris was great for long enough. And it felt like that was the argument people were having back and forth, right?
I think that was it. And I think there was still this deathless attachment to wins and pitcher wins and losses.
Sure, sure.
You know, and that winning percentage, pitcher winning percentage means something. And, you know, I Baseball Prospectus beat that out of me, you know, by 2004, even
right.
Like it just, you know, very quickly beat that out of me. And if I could have gotten away with not putting in pitcher wins and losses in this book, I might've tried it. But you know, ultimately I decided, no, that's probably not the way to go. You know, so the notion of Morris's greatness, you know, I think hinges on those one loss records rather than his earned run averages, because
right.
We're talking about a guy who never had an ERA below 3 in a, yep. in a regular season. You know, there's no 220s on his mark or anything like that. There's no times when he was just, you know, and there's only a couple 200 strikeout seasons. It's not like he was blowing guys away. You know, so I think you're onto something there. I think, you know, there was also this notion that one or two shining moments in the postseason makes up for those shortcomings. And, you know, I'm the first to admit and to warn anybody who's using my system that, you know, Jaws doesn't account for everything. It doesn't account for the postseason. It doesn't account for awards or historical importance. And there's certainly room to argue for all of those things. You know, which can sway a borderline, you know, a thinking on a borderline candidate, I think quite significantly. But you know, the fact that, say, Jack Morris's postseason numbers are really just a microcosm of his regular season numbers. His ERA is 3.80. He's, you know, as opposed to 3.90 for the regular season, and he had some real duds. Like he's one of the big reasons that Tigers didn't get to the World Series in '87. You know, because he pitched a dud actually opposite Blyleven.
And Blyleven, right.
And Blyleven had some big postseason moments as well, not just in '87, but also '79, coming out of the bullpen, you know, when the Pirates were down 3-1 and absolutely needed somebody to hold the line and he was nails for the rest of the game. I think it's 4 or 5 innings out of the bullpen. It was more than just you know, the career peak argument. It did turn people's attention away from wins and losses and towards run prevention, and in particular relative run prevention when considering ballpark and league scoring environments. And the fact that you know, Jack Morris has an ERA plus of 105 and Burt Blyleven's like 117 or 118, you know, I think, you know, in a larger sum of innings, I think really started to focus you know, the importance of those types of things.
Well, but I agree with that. But I think this is where it comes back to the career and the height of this thing. I think that when you look at Jack Morris and Burt Blyleven, just look at their numbers straight. Morris, you know, won fewer games, had whatever, 1,400 fewer strikeouts or whatever it was, pitched fewer innings. You know, there's no... It, you know, he had a better win percentage or whatever. His career playoff numbers are not as good. There was nothing to point to Morris as a better pitcher in the career numbers than Burt Blyleven. So the argument was, yeah, but Blyleven was never a great pitcher. And Jack Morris was a great pitcher for, you know, whatever. He most wins
right.
in the 80s and
right.
and whatever, started 8 straight opening days, whatever the arguments were. And again, I'm not, and I don't think you are either. I think Jack Morris is going to get into the Hall of Fame. I think that what the Morris-Blylevin argument did was really open up this Hall of Fame discussion to, hey, you know, just because Jack Morris was viewed as a better player when he was playing than Burt Blylevin doesn't mean he was a better player. And I think that's why this book is so fun, because I think it used to be, hey, if somebody was viewed as a Hall of Famer while they were playing, they became a Hall of Famer. Inevitably, I think that's
right. They had the fame going for them.
They,
you know,
had the fame.
It's kind of a circular argument, and it's one I was reminded of just this past weekend in Cooperstown, because somebody brought it up. He's in the Hall of Fame because he's famous,
and that's not true. I don't buy that.
Well, I think there's something to that, and I think when you the further back you go, to a certain point. You know, there are a lot of guys who were in the Hall of Fame in part because they had maybe two or three or sometimes even one big World Series. Bill Mazeroski, for example.
Yes.
Lefty Gomez, I think 6-2 in World Series play. And there's some other guys like that. You know, this is when the World Series, even before television, was capturing national attention and was on the front pages of every newspaper. And that kind of fame, you know, is just unthinkable today. You know, in a lot of cases, but you know, when you don't have a baseball encyclopedia in front of you, and we didn't have baseball encyclopedias in front of us, before Macmillan in 1969, the notion of what makes a Hall of Famer is more and more abstract and is more reliant on fame. And now that we've got more tools to drill down and get a more accurate assessment of these players' careers, you know, our definition, you know, has changed. You know, we want to recognize, you know, the true elites rather than just make it a popularity contest.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's 100% right. I think that there's no question whether or not he's a great pitcher and obviously one of my favorite little sections in this thing. But Dizzy Dean is in the Hall of Fame because Dizzy Dean was famous. That's why Dizzy Dean is in the Hall of Fame. And that was the way it was. And there are people that think it should still be that way and still think that Steve Garvey should be in the Hall of Fame because he was famous and everybody thought he should be in the Hall of Fame. And that's, that's one way to view it. I think this way that we're talking about, where you really break down a player's career and look at it, is a much more interesting way to look at the Hall of Fame. And I think, you know, obviously this is why we love talking about it. But before we do that, I want to, we need to talk about some players coming up, because that's what people care about. And so I want to talk about the 2018 ballot, and maybe we'll go on to 19 and 20, but I want to talk about the 18 ballot, because I was looking at the 18 ballot just based on Jaws, and obviously everybody knows. So Jaws is this combination of a player's peak and a combination of his player's career. And you compare their Jaws score against the Jaws scores, the average Jaws scores of their position, right?
Correct. Yeah. And the idea is to highlight candidates who are at least as good as the average Hall of Famer in hopes of, you know, maintaining or resuscitating what, you know, especially at the time that I created the system, felt like eroding standards.
Exactly.
We wanted to restore some of the sheen to the Hall of Fame by recognizing these guys who are really, really worthy of the honor.
So here's what I got, though. This is where it gets interesting. Based on what I am seeing, ten players on next year's ballot whose Jaws is higher than the Jaws of their position. So I see 10 players plus two more in Vlad Guerrero and
Trevor Hoffman.
Trevor Hoffman, who are going to go in, who are going to get elected. I mean, I think Trevor Hoffman at 74% of the vote, he came whatever, four or five votes short or three, I don't even remember.
Right.
And I think Vlad Guerrero had more than 70%. He's going to get in too. So those two guys are going to get in. And then there are 10 other guys. So everybody keeps talking about, oh, the ballot is finally beginning to shrink down, but it isn't, is it? I mean, it's still an overwhelming ballot at the moment.
Yeah, it is. And this has been the case really since 2013, since that big class, Bonds, Clemens, Sosa, Piazza, and Schilling hit. We've had as many as 17 guys, I think, exceed the standards at, at their position. And I just, you know, that's nuts. And that's why, you know, I was why I volunteered to help the BBWAA out a couple of years ago for, you know, what that committee that was chaired by Susan Slusser, and that was in, you know, just informally, we called it the Ballot Study Committee.
Right.
I don't know if it ever had an official name, but, you know, we ended up recommending that the slots be increased to 12, but only because we didn't think they would go for, the hall would go for 15. As it was, 12 was too spicy for them.
Yeah, they didn't want it.
You know, so so we didn't get anything out of that. It was officially, the motion was officially tabled.
Well, I think the Hall of Fame pretty clearly just, anything that in their mind would diminish standards, or at least publicly give the perception of diminished standards, they're opposed to. They
we knew they wouldn't budge at 75%. You know, we weren't about to ask that because we were told going in, like, don't even ask. And so, all right, that's off the table. We're not, you know, we're not going to ask for that, even though, you know, I think you can make a case that once you get past 50%, the rest is just bureaucracy.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
bureaucratic delays, and filibustering.
You know, right. That's right.
For whatever better word. We're dealing with these very stacked ballots, and it requires every voter to conduct, you know, a kind of triage, because you have to take a look at. You know, you can take a look at guys and say, oh, Larry Walker's in his eighth year. I think he's a Hall of Famer, but geez, he's getting only 21%, you know, 21.9% of the vote last year. He's never going to make that up in 3 years. Sorry, Larry. I think it's more important to make sure that Scott Rolen doesn't fall off the ballot.
And that's exactly the game.
Position.
Yeah, that's the games we're in. I mean, that's the games. Last year, I think there were 13 I wanted to vote for, but I mean, I voted for Larry Walker, fearing he might fall off the ballot. And didn't vote for Vlad Guerrero, who I actually think is a Hall of Famer, even though he falls a little short in the jaws. I mean, I, right. I have him as a Hall of Famer. So, but here the new guys that are coming on the ballot. So Chipper Jones, everybody knows he's going to get elected. He'll get elected with a pretty high percentage of the vote, I would think.
And he's got a shot at being the first unanimous guy because you know we've got this move to transparency this year. Every ballot will become public knowledge a week after the election. Who's going to stand up and thump their chest and say, I don't think Chipper Jones is a Hall of Famer?
Somebody will.
Somebody might. And, you know, it's not that Chipper Jones is more worthy of that honor than anybody who came before, but he's first in line. You know, so before we talk about whether Derek Jeter will be the first or right. Mariano Rivera will be the first, you know, until then, it's Chipper who's first in the box.
And he is an obvious choice. So, I mean, Yes, somebody is going to have to say, I didn't vote for Chipper Jones. But, of course, now, because of the triage you're talking about, you can fall back on that too. You could say, hey, look, I knew he was going to get in. There are 10 others that I felt like I needed to give my support to. So I don't think he'll be unanimous, but he's going to be in the high 90s, I would think.
Sure.
Is Jim Tomey going to go in on first ballot?
You know, it seems ridiculous that he wouldn't, given 612 career home runs, but right. I guess in theory it's possible. I mean, we're talking about a guy who had no tangible connection to performance enhancing drugs. Nobody right. even like, you know, nobody with any even like shred of credibility ever suggested that Jim Tomey was on. Nope. I mean, this is a big lumpy guy who could hit the ball a country mile. You know, and you know, he was you know, he had his limitations elsewhere. But boy, could he kill it.
And kill it, 400 and a 400 on base percentage. I mean,
that's legitimately feared in the box. And you know, I guess I could see, you know, enough curmudgeon saying, no, he didn't feel like a Hall of Famer to me, never won MVP, you know, or, you know, something dumb like that. And, you know, so it could happen with this crowd atop the ballot with, and I just realized I've been misrepresenting Hoffman and Vlad in this round of interviews by saying that it was Vlad who had 74% and Hoffman had low 70s, and now it's the other way around.
Right, right.
So, you know, 25 different interviews I did over the last week, I'm going to have to retract or issue.
Yeah, they're close enough. They're both going in.
They're both going in. I mean, they're both like gimme putts away at this point here. So, you know, and it's a rarity to get a four-man class. You know, we had one in 2015, and that was the first since 1955. So, you know, to presume that we're going to get another, particularly when we've got so many other candidates that are in need of support, you know, with
let's talk about some of those, because you got Scott Rolen, because there's a guy that I think has a, you know, this is one of those things where you know, his, first of all, his jaws is better. Is he has a Hall of Fame jaws. He's a guy who I think the more you look at his career, the more you realize how great he really was. And he's somebody who needs time, I think, to really build sort of the consensus of what a great player he was, you know, as third basemen often do. And I don't know if he's going to get that time. I mean, I just don't know. What do you think?
I think Scott Rolen is Adrian Beltre without the finishing kick. I mean, he is a guy who had a lot of injuries from his mid-30s onward. A lot of his value rests on defense. You know, he does have the gold gloves. I think he's actually got more than Beltre does, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, 8. I think Beltre's got 5.
Yeah.
But only 2,077 hits and 316 home runs. Only.
Yeah. Jeez, gosh. I know.
You know, but you know, he played his last game at age 37, and you know, his last few years were racked with injuries. I mean, you know, from the last time he played 140 games was age 31.
Yeah.
You know, he did get over the 2,000 hit mark, which, as I note about 17 times in the book, has been a bright line test for expansion era Hall of Famers. If you don't get to 2,000, good night. You know, good Mark McGwire, Bobby Gritch, you know, Dick Allen, Tony Oliva, Minnie Minoso. I mean, it's been the death of a lot of candidacies.
Yeah.
And one of those guys is going to break it someday, but until they do, I'm not banking on any particular one of them. Yeah, I worry that Rolen is going to fall off the ballot, and I also, in retrospect, I'm kind of kicking myself that I didn't include a Rolen essay in this book. I'm not sure who I would throw out for that, you know, because as it is, I went 96 pages past my projected page count and basically just
you could have done 100 more.
I basically just held my breath until they said yes, you know, I was not going to be denied, and I think they respected the fact that that the material was good enough. And they respected the fact that I made some hard cuts, like leaving the Jeff Bagwell and Yvonne Rodriguez chapters aside once they were elected.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, three guys.
So Rolen, I think eminently worthy. I have him as a top 10 third baseman all time, 10th in jaws, in fact, and above on peak and career. So, you know, this is a guy who's definitely worth a vote. And at the same time, I worry that he is at risk to fall off the ballot.
All right, let's take a second here to thank our sponsor, Volvo. You can still join Volvo for their Midsommar sales event and get up to $4,500 off on select Volvo vehicles. Enjoy standard features like keyless entry, rear park assist camera, navigation system, and more. But hurry, summer doesn't last forever. Take advantage of this limited time offer today. Visit your local Volvo dealer for details. Offers does exclude all V90, XC90 Momentum, and XC90 Excellence. Standard features vary by model. See your dealer for details. And now, back to the interview with Jay. Three guys who have very, very different backings. I think we know which is the one that's going to probably go forward. But three guys, and Jaws is, you know, not super high on any of the three. Andrew Jones, Johan Santana, and Omar Vizquel. And well, all three of them are coming on the ballot next year, and all three are really interesting in their own way.
Yeah, Jones is a guy who I've got in the book, and he's actually well above the peak in center field.
Yeah.
And just a little short in career. He's 10th at the position all time too. So, you know, this is a guy who I guess 9th in peak. Okay. And above the standard in peak. And he's got 1,933 hits. I'm afraid for him. I'm glad I put his essay in the book. You look at those Braves rotations, and of the three guys that are in the Hall of Fame, Greg Maddux, Tom Glavin, and
John Smoltz.
John Smoltz. The only one of those who was really a strikeout pitcher was Smoltz. Where did those balls in play go to die? They went into Andrew Jones's glove.
Yeah, he was amazing.
You know, he was the centerpiece of that defense, much more so than any shortstop they had during that career, because they kept changing shortstops. But he was the constant there with those 10 gold gloves.
Yeah.
And I definitely think he's worthy of the recognition.
He's worthy of recognition. I think it's going to be tough for him. I think it's going to be very, very tough for Santana because his career was so short. But, I mean, we're talking dominance for whatever, five-year span. And I don't think he's going to get a tremendous amount of support just because the ballot is so loaded. But I think Vizquel's going to get quite a bit of support, and there's Jaws is not kind to Omar Vizquel.
To say the least, Vizquel, I think he's below even Rabbit Moranville, in terms of the shortstops in Jaws, and Rabbit's the lowest. We're talking about a guy who I think this is going to be a potential Jack Morris situation, a very polarizing candidate who some people, feel like passed the eye test and beloved to a certain extent. Yeah, he's five notches below Rabbit in Jaws, and Rabbit is with a much lower peak too. In fact, somebody was asking me this the other day, what I thought of Andrelton Simmons as well, and I noted that Simmons in I think 5 years and change on either side already has a peak that is essentially the equivalent of Vizquel, who played for 20 some years, and has this really minimal peak. Vizquel's proponents want to say he was the successor to Ozzie Smith,
right?
But neither the fielding numbers nor the offensive numbers come close to measuring up once you adjust for his environment, once you include base running, and all of that. Oh, Ozzie added a tremendous value on the base paths and became a legitimately solid hitter in St. Louis, learned, how to hit the ball on the ground consistently and took advantage of the turf. Omar played in a higher scoring era and just, had a couple big seasons, but never really consistently helped his teams with the bat. And the defensive metrics just aren't there for him, even though we've got, 10 times as much highlight film of him that you can access from your desktop.
Well, that's what's going to happen. I mean, look, and I love Omar Vizquel. I love him. I mean, obviously, with him in Cleveland and being a Clevelander, love the guy. You're going to have people that are going to say he was the defensive wizard of his time, even though the numbers do really not support that. He has 2,877 hits. I mean, he's really close to 3,000 hits as a shortstop with 400 stolen bases. That people are going to cherry pick that and point out, those numbers and saying, well, with his defense, with all of that he's going to get a lot of support. I really believe he's going to get a lot of support.
I know that. I have the Vizquel essay ready. That was another one that I pulled from the book, and I decided, why do I want to, if I'm cutting guys, why do I want to keep in a guy who my system just does not like? and I don't want to offend anybody. I know Omar in particular is beloved by his countrymen.
Yeah.
From Venezuela, beloved, in Cleveland and whatever. And I think the problem with this all is you end up, and I learned this from the Jack Morris thing, is you end up arguing vehemently against somebody's inclusion in the Hall of Fame, but that doesn't mean you think that they're garbage. And Omar Vizquel is not garbage.
He just
doesn't quite meet the standard. And I'll have to leave it to somebody else to make a stronger case for him, because I refuse to. My numbers say he's a terrible Hall of Famer.
Well, that's the problem. But that is the problem. The problem is, you're right, we're discussing the greatest players in the history of the game, and the standards that the Hall of Fame has set up over whatever 80 years or so of being around, and that's it. We're not, and I always felt really, especially toward the end, because I wrote so, how many Jack Morris pieces I wrote. And after a while, and first of all, I like Jack personally, and I have no beef with Jack Morris. I think Jack Morris was a very, very fine pitcher. He was a workhorse. He pitched 200 innings every year. He had the great World Series. If he goes to the Hall of Fame, I'm absolutely going to shake his hand and congratulate him and say, that's awesome. Good for you. That's nothing personal and nothing against what a career he had.
Jack Morris didn't ask to become a symbol in a culture war.
He said some
silly things to certain people the value of sabermetrics. He's old school, but he doesn't deserve the level of rancor that has been attached to his candidacy, and that unfortunately is just a byproduct of you know, the levels of volume that people reach when they're arguing passionately about this stuff.
And that's how important it is. And by the way, Jack has said some things through the years that I'm really not super happy with. So
yeah,
I'm not trying to either defend Jack as a human being either. I mean, it's just, the point is that when we have these kinds of conversations and these kinds of discussions, we're starting from the point, hey, these are all really, really good players. We're starting from that point. And when I say, well, I think Jack Morris is not a Hall of Famer, that's all I'm saying. When I say Omar Vizquel is not a Hall of Famer, that's all I'm saying. I'm not saying Omar Vizquel wasn't awesome. He was awesome, super fun to watch. The barehanded plays that he made were terrific. But you look at the great players in the Hall of Fame, Alan Trammell was a greater player than Omar Vizquel. Alan Trammell's not in the Hall of Fame. You could probably list off probably four or five shortstops minimum, you know? I don't know. I mean, I saw somebody Well, that's the thing. I saw somebody yesterday say, oh, he's like Ozzy. And I'm like, he's not even, you know, he's not Dave Concepcion, really.
Right.
I mean, when you look at it, so.
He's not Jimmy Rollins.
I mean, there you go.
Yeah, we could do this all day. Or Tony Fernandez or yes, we could do this all day.
And we really could. and we won't. All right. Over the next 4 or 5 years, as you mentioned, that we are entering a different era where every single ballot will be made public. And once that happens, and let's face it, most people make their ballots public now. But the ones who have not made their ballots public are probably, they're probably going to be some pretty shaky choices in there. And it's going to be different when that comes under public scrutiny. So we really do have an opportunity in the next 5-6 years to get either the first unanimous player or the first player who's like falls a vote or two short, like somebody who's right on the brink, right? Who's it going to be? Who is going to either be unanimous or sort of make it so close that there will be a unanimous player down the road?
Right. I mean, I think, like I said, I think Chipper's got a shot. I think Mariano's got a shot. But if it gets past, if either of those guys doesn't get it, then I think it's going to be Jeter.
I think it's going to be Jeter.
I mean, he's got the hit totals. He's got the rings. He's got the batting average. He's got the fame. I mean, really, you know, who is going to object to that? Who, like, I mean, certainly a fan, there are fans who will object to it just to right. be just to be contrarians. But there is not going to be any writer worth his salt or her salt that has any wants to maintain any shred of credibility in this area who could argue otherwise. You know, we're not beholden to the fact that Babe Ruth wasn't unanimous or Ty Cobb wasn't unanimous. You know, and I think that's going to be silly. So yeah, I would say it's Jeter. And after that, you know, there's probably nobody upcoming for a good long time, because you look at even the quality from 2021 and 2022 drops off considerably. You know, Tim Hudson and Torrey Hunter are the best candidates on 2021. Yeah. Nobody, you know, neither of them is going to make it.
No.
Alex Rodriguez in 2022. Good luck with that.
Yeah.
David Ortiz as a DH. I mean, you know, I say in the book, my hunch is he makes it, maybe not first ballot, but he's going to make it despite the fact that Jaws is not a huge fan of him. You know, we're, after that, you're looking at, you know, who's active here and when do we think they're going to retire? You know, and it becomes a complete exercise in speculation, and we don't know how long Clayton Kershaw is going to last, or Mike Trout or Bryce Harper or Chris Bryant or, you know, whomever. These people who are off to great starts in their careers, you know,
yeah,
how they're going to last and what the objections could be to their candidacies once they, you know, if they do.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think Chipper will fall short, if for no other reason. He doesn't have 3,000 hits, doesn't have 500 home runs. He doesn't have quite that, like, you know, where every single person basically has no choice but to vote for him kind of thing. He's certainly a Hall of Famer. I think he's going to fall. I think he's going to be high 90s. I just don't think he's going to be the one that's going to break sort of through that glass ceiling. Mariano should do that, in my view, and I'm not, you know, I don't think any relievers basically should be in the Hall of Fame, or very few relievers should be in the Hall
right.
of Fame.
Yeah, but, I mean, we're talking, yeah.
It should be Mariano and nobody, basically, at this point. He's that much better in my mind, and maybe not nobody, but Mariano, and, you know, I think you make a decent argument for Gossage and a couple others.
Right. Did you include Hoffman on your ballot?
I did not. I did not.
I understand. I understand that. I respect that. I don't think I could include Hoffman, under certain circumstances. But I've kind of come around to his candidacy, not based on Jaws, but based on win probability added. I think is the most revealing stat about him. And I'm interested in looking more closely at what that new Nate Silver thing, the goose eggs, says about him and other believers.
Look, he's an absolute superstar and a great Hall of Fame candidate. I just didn't have room for him on my ballot.
I understand that. Yeah.
That's how that goes. All right, last question. Of the guys on the ballot, who is the one sort of who is your pet project? I would just say that. Who is the one guy, Edgar?
Edgar Martinez, because I think people want to slag him as being just a DH,
which is ridiculous.
First of all, he played more than 500 games in the field at third base, and he was more than competent at it. The metrics actually credit him with being above average. You go back to the scouting reports when he was coming up, and they say he's certainly playable there. There's nobody knocking him. It's not like we're talking about the second coming of Ryan Braun at third base.
Right.
It was the string of injuries that led the Mariners to put him at DH. So he's got 72% of his career as a DH. But the thing is that even with the extra, I think it's 7.5 runs a year between the positional adjustment between third base and DH, even with that tax in WAR, it goes from like +2 to -5 or something like that, with an extra half run in there somewhere. He is still better than the average Hall of Fame third baseman, better than the average Hall of Fame position player overall. And I've spent the better part of a decade trying to hammer that home to voters and other believers or other observers, and we're making some headway here. He's had two large gains in a row to get to 58.6%.
Yes.
With 2 years to go. Like Tim Raines, he had the cruelty of losing 5 years of eligibility through no fault of his own.
Right.
But he's actually in slightly better shape than Raines was 2 years ago. I think Raines was at 55% two years ago. So suddenly this seems doable. Now, Edgar, there's an additional connection there. I was born in Seattle. I have family on both sides in Seattle. My uncle, who worked for the Mariners, was the head concierge at the Diamond Club in his sort of post-retirement job.
Nice.
And there's a special connection there. He passed away in January when I was wrapping up the manuscript of this book, he was on my mind a lot. And I know in our last conversation, I said I was working hard to get Edgar in. So
that's awesome.
I really do hope he's in, and he's a guy to whom I have a similar emotional response as I do to Tim Raines. Raines was a favorite from my childhood. Not to the extent that he was for Jonah Carey, because Jonah lived in Montreal, and he had that extra special closeness. Edgar, I was an admirer from afar. But when I could watch those West Coast games, watching him hit was always a pleasure. And geez, just remember what he did in that 95 division series and what that, what the dump meant to keeping that team in Seattle, I think is really cool. So, I want to do what I can. I don't imagine myself going to the same lengths as Rich Letterer or Jonah Carey, going door to door, knocking on doors and saying, are you a Hall of Fame voter? Will you vote for Edgar Martinez? But, I'd like to think that if he does get in, that my efforts will have had something to do with it.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I think he's absolutely should be in the Hall of Fame. It's ridiculous, and what you hope for this year is a big jump for him. I mean, you hope if he gets up into the mid to high 60s this year, he'll get in.
I just want to keep the momentum rolling. I mean, he looked buried 2 years ago. Let's see here. He was at 27% in 2015. His support has more than doubled in 2 years. I mean, he was falling off from around 37%. A couple years before that, but yeah, he looked dead and buried, and now he's to 43.4 and then 58.6. So, you know, he's moving in the right direction. This is, I think, one of the biggest two-year gains in the modern election period that we've seen already. So, you know, I do hope he keeps it going.
Me too. Me too. Well, Jay, I can't thank you enough for joining us. The book is the Cooperstown Casebook, Who's in the Baseball Hall of Fame, Who Should Be In, and Who Should Pack Their Plaques, available at all bookstores and Amazon and all those other things. Hope to have you back on as we get a little closer to the Hall of Fame.
Absolutely. I'll always talk Hall with you, Joe.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jay.
Sure thing.